the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take Two, me Martinez. Bipartisanship in Sacramento is hard to come by unless lawmakers are playing their annual softball game. Plus, what's our official state fruit? Unless you said avocados, you'd be wrong, but be forgiven if you thought it was this.
You can't exaggerate the importance of the orange on California. California was the orange, and the orange was California.
It's all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I mean, Martinez.
Looks like we made it.
Aw, yeah. Soak it in. We did make it to Friday. We got a packed show today as well. Coming up, tenancy in common housing is trying to gain a foothold here in Los Angeles.
But really, no one owns any individual unit. You all have a share of the property, and your share, it could be different based on the property.
Find out how this affordable option may have some good and bad repercussions on the LA housing market. But we're going to start things off, as we do every Friday, with State of Affairs. It's our weekly peek at politics in the Golden State. And this week,
this Trump rule weaponizes nutrition, healthcare, and housing. It acts like a ticking time bomb.
And then there were 56 lawsuits. California Attorney General Javier Becerra says he'll sue the Trump administration again after it was announced that immigrants who use public assistance will be blocked from receiving green cards. Meanwhile, AB 5 could be one of the most consequential bills in the state, so why has Governor Newsom remained mum? We're going to get into those stories and more with Carla Marinucci, senior editor for Politico's California Playbook. Welcome back, Carla.
Hey, A, good to be with you.
Also with us, John Myers, Sacramento Bureau Chief for the LA Times. Welcome to you, John.
Thank you. Happy Friday.
All right. Now, Becerra's announcement came down earlier today. California and three other states are going to sue. Here's a little more from today's press conference.
This rule creates a strict standard, so strict that if it were applied to U.S. citizens, a substantial portion of people across this country who are U.S. citizens would be considered likely as public charges and not qualify for the services that this administration would like to deny children and working families.
Carla, it's the second lawsuit California has filed against the administration this week. What's at stake for the state in these cases?
Well, you know, Governor Gavin Newsom joked today that he never expected to start his week defending the bald eagle and end it by defending the Statue of Liberty. And that's pretty much in a nutshell how California officials are seeing it. The first action was earlier this week, and that's when the state challenged the Trump administration's efforts to weaken the Endangered Species Act. You know, that's the law created with helping to save the bald eagle, the California condor. It was signed into law by President Richard Nixon. But today it was Becerra and Newsom announcing, as you said, number 56 against the Trump administration with regard to the so-called public charge issue, that is, legal immigrants who receive public assistance for food and health care. And the reason is there is a lot at stake, as you said, because California is home to the most immigrants in the country, 10 million legal and illegal immigrants. And Becerra made the point that today that half of the state's kids have an immigrant parent. You know, there's a UCLA study that said that as many as 756,000 people across the state could lose Medi-Cal and food stamps just because of fear alone. 7 out of 10 who could be affected by this would be children. So lots at stake for California, and both Newsom and Becerra were really strong on it, and they plan to really push ahead on this one.
And I was thinking to myself why the number 56 means so much to me. It's Joe DiMaggio's hitting streak, 56 games.
There you go.
Yeah, from San Francisco, Joe DiMaggio. All right, John, now so much of California's fight with the administration is really centered around policies toward undocumented people. Seems to be mark a big change in direction for the White House. How would you characterize this move, and why do you think they're making it now?
I don't know if I think that it's a change as much as it is an expansion, A. I mean, it clearly is engaging or seeking to engage people on a larger discussion about immigration, legal and illegal immigration. And I think, you know, the most fascinating part about this is that we have heard all through the Trump administration that California immigrants who often live in blended families, they know someone whose documented status is in question, they have a family member, that that this has a ripple effect, that this worries everyone. And so I think this is a broader conversation. This is a national conversation about immigration now. I mean, certainly we have seen it with the census and asking immigration status on census questions. Now we're seeing it with public services. And so I just think this is a broader conversation. It's probably ultimately a conversation America should have, but he is clearly seeking to draw all of this together, legal or illegal. It's politically explosive, I think. It's going to be really interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, 10 million immigrants in California, half the state's children have an immigrant parent. Let's zoom in on the California Republican Party, because on the one hand, they're trying to regrow. On the other, President Trump is putting them in a tough spot. Carla, have we heard much from them on this front?
No, we have not heard much from them on this front. I mean, the Trump administration itself, of course, says this is an attempt to make sure tax dollars are effectively used. And as Ken Cuccinelli put it, the official spokesman for Trump on this immigration issue, he says they want to encourage people, immigrants who can stand on their own 2 feet. But we note that an AP analysis found that low-income immigrants use food stamps and Medicaid and SSI really at a lower rate than Native Americans. It's interesting, that Kevin McCarthy and the head of the Republican Party here in California have sort of been silent on this move this week. But there, have been some Republicans who have spoken up, like a GOP strategist Mike Madrid, who says this is really another bid to sort of stoke the fire and keep the party's base energized for 2020. But the part of the issue they've had in California is the Latino voter base, one of the fastest growing voter bases in the state. And are they going to lose that one again when it comes to 2020?
You know, some people have made the connection between the administration's moves and Prop 187 in California. That would have made immigrants residing in the country without legal permission ineligible for public benefits. Some analysts think that that proposition helped doom the GOP in California. John, do you see any evidence that would support or maybe take away from this comparison?
I certainly understand the comparison, right? Because we are talking about public services, healthcare services, possibly education services. The details are different, but the message does feel the same. And I think there's a lot of strong evidence to show that that was a watershed moment in the Republican Party's reputation in California. I think it started splitting immigrant groups away from the party. It made the party seem to be more of a white traditional party. I understand the comparison. And I think that the reaction in California and maybe in other parts of the country in very strong communities that immigrants have grown a lot in, and parts of Texas and other parts of the Southwest, this is going to be really, really interesting to watch. This does have those hallmarks of that kind of political fight of one group versus another.
Carla, I'm going to bring up my Republican uncle who lives in Koreatown. He has said that Pete Wilson used 187 to become governor at the expense of the rest of the GOP in California.
Yeah, and many people would say that they have paid for it ever since. I mean, to this day, right now in Sacramento, there is not a single Republican Latino legislator. And I think that the party officials have got to be concerned about that as they look ahead at their future in a state where the Latino population is growing at a very rapid pace.
Talking State of Affairs with Carla Marinucci, senior editor for Politico's California Playbook, also John Meyer, Sacramento Bureau Chief for the L.A. Times. Now moving on, AB 5, that's a bill that could have a huge effect on how people work in the state. It would turn gig economy workers into company employees. And for the state's booming tech industry, that could mean a 20-30% cost increase. Governor Newsom has refused to put his finger on the scale either way. John, why do you think that is?
Because I don't think it's entirely clear where this one falls out, I mean, if you look back, I mean, this entire piece of legislation's impetus was a California Supreme Court ruling that said that a lot of these independent contractors, and this is the gig economy, the ride share, the other places, that these people had to be treated like full employees. And so if you look at organized labor's position, their point is, look, we've got a Supreme Court ruling. We don't have to do anything else. They're basically saying it's up to business to figure out whether or not you're going to come to the table and figure out how to make this work. The governor is from San Francisco. He was the mayor of San Francisco. He loves the innovation of Silicon Valley. He has firm roots in organized labor as well. It's a tough position to be in. The governor's folks say they are engaged behind the scenes, but the governor has not been vocal out in front on this. I'm not sure that he necessarily could have solved it if he did, but we've got about 3.5 weeks left to go in Sacramento. It's going to be interesting to see what happens.
You know, Governor Newsom has a bit of a mixed record when it comes to taking the lead, when it comes to big and complicated issues. Most notably, he didn't really flex his political muscles when it came to SB 50. That would have made it easier to build apartments and near public transit. Carla, what's the risk for Newsom if he doesn't lead on this?
Well, you know, it's interesting because on this issue particularly, the issue of the future of work and, you know, on thorny things like robotics and AI, Gavin Newsom has actually been consumed with these issues for years. He's talked about them. He's written about them. These are not easy issues to put on a bumper sticker or to talk about in any, you know, simple way. And when we saw him yesterday in San Francisco, you know, Newsom insisted he is spending a lot of time on this issue with both tech people and the labor insiders. And he talked about how, listen, he's been talking 6 hours a day with some of these folks, and his chief of staff is as well. But you're absolutely right. Most labor people and most, you know, industry analysts will tell you this issue of work and the future of work is the issue that is going to define California, particularly when it comes to the tech industry in the next generation. And public officials have got to get themselves around it, whether Newsom does or not. Yeah, labor won't forget it. Neither will tech if he doesn't get on this one. And he knows that, I think.
All right. Second to last thing today, Republican Congressman Devin Nunes. In elections past, he has appeared on ballots as a farmer. Now, that designation has been challenged by Democrats. A development now, Carla. What is that development?
Well, you know, Nunes has made the roots of his Central Valley farming family sort of the hallmark of his career. And in the last cycle, of course, the Democrats challenged him. They called him a fake farmer after it was revealed that, hey, the family farm had moved to Iowa. And he actually sued people over that who claimed he was a fake farmer. But now new financial disclosures are kind of interesting. A SACB reported that this week that his financial disclosure form shows that for the first time he's claiming a farm as part of his assets. But here's the rub here. The farm is worth less than $15,000 and has never generated any income. And by the way, $15,000 worth of land in the Central Valley these days is about 100 square feet.
Yeah, I was thinking I could afford it almost.
Once again, headlines with regard to Devin Newsom and the farming issue aren't looking good, kind of, as he heads toward 2020.
And John, Carla's mentioned, you know, all the times he sued Twitter over parody accounts, sued the Fresno Bee. Why do you think this is his seemingly stock response when he gets criticized?
I wish I had a great response for you, I don't know, but I will say this. Devin Nunes has never been a guy that we talked about in California political circles until Donald Trump, until he took prominence in the Washington discussion, the Russia investigation. He did not come up like other Republicans. You know, he won the seat handily. He never faced any stiff competition. I don't know. Maybe he just has not been in the rough and tumble world of political fighting before, but it is fascinating. And this is a guy now who is in a territory, seems like me, that's completely different from anything he ever came up in politics. I have no idea, but I have a feeling it's going to follow him into the next year's election.
John Myers, Sacramento Bureau Chief for the LA Times. Carla Marinucci, Senior Editor for Politico's California Playbook. Carla, John, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome.
LA was built on the idea that all that wide open space meant that everyone would eventually be able to have their dream house someday. Well, it hasn't quite worked out that way. Skyrocketing rents means people just can't save enough to buy a house that's already super expensive or maybe overpriced to begin with. So what to do about real estate reality destroying your homeowning dream? You do what superheroes do these days and team up. No, not roommates. It's owning your own private place on a property you co-own with others on that property. Yep, that's a thing here in LA, and it has a name. Find out what it is when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Is your beloved car ready for retirement? It's been good to you, so give it a proper send-off by donating it to KPCC. We'll pick up your vehicle, handle all the paperwork, and use the proceeds from its sale to power the news and programming you love on KPCC. You could also get a tax deduction. It's easy to do and makes a big difference to independent, fact-based journalism in your community. Go to kpcc.org/cars.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. Amy Martinez. Joshua trees are a Southern California icon, but environmental groups say the plant's future is in jeopardy because of climate change. Recent studies have shown that by the end of the century, most of the land in Joshua Tree National Park won't be able to nurture the next generation of trees. So the groups petitioned the federal government to have the trees listed under the Endangered Species Act. Here's Taylor Jones from the organization Wild Earth Guardians, who we interviewed back in 2016.
One of the things that the Endangered Species Act listing does is shines a light on the fact that there is a problem.
Now, this week, however, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced that the Joshua tree would not get special protections under the act. Jane Hendron is here to explain why. She's a spokesperson for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Jane, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you for having me.
So why did your agency decide against listing Joshua trees in the Endangered Species Act?
Well, we assessed the Joshua tree across the entirety of its range, which includes parts of California, Arizona, Nevada, and Utah. So it's a very widely distributed plant. We determined that even looking 80 years into the future, this plant does have resilience, and we believe that it will continue to be well represented within its range into the future.
And just to be clear, the range, as you mentioned, it's not just the place Joshua tree that we here in Los Angeles know and love. It's the entirety of its range extending into those states.
That is correct.
Now, if the species were protected, what would have changed effectively? Would there be new resources available to spend on the tree's conservation or maybe limiting developments that encroach on its habitat?
If it was to have been listed under the Act, there are requirements for federal agencies that undertake projects or issue permits on their land to consult with the service to assess the impacts of those projects. We would be identifying potentially a recovery plan of what actions could be taken to help conserve it.
So it would sound like it would get a lot more attention and things around the plant would get a lot more scrutiny if it were under this act.
Potentially, it's the profile that could come with saying that it is a listed species. But our focus is right now on identifying the fact that this plant is in okay shape. It does not need protection. But that doesn't mean we are not interested in working with partners to identify some important research needs for this species.
Talking to Jane Hendron, spokesperson for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Now, there are many studies out there that warn about the fate of Joshua trees because of climate change. One published a few months ago by UC Riverside said only 0.02% of the tree's habitat in Joshua Tree National Park would remain viable if things continue the way they are. And then another out of UC Santa Cruz says the moths that help Joshua trees don't fare very well in hotter temperatures. So why does your department's decision make sense in the face of the prevailing science on the future of these trees?
It's important to note that that particular study out of UC Riverside was only looking at a portion of Joshua trees, specifically within Joshua Tree National Park. Our review looked at the entire range of the species, and we do acknowledge that there may be some contraction in the southern part of the range due to a hotter, drier climate over time. But that it's also likely there would be areas, even in the southern part, that could still host Joshua trees. They may be at higher elevations or on north-facing slopes. And conversely, there could also be some movement northward into a range expansion.
Jane, I understand what you mean, that there's still going to be Joshua trees all over its range, in Nevada and Arizona as well. But what do you say to folks who are thinking, wait a second, in Joshua Tree National Park, there's going to be fewer Joshua trees? That doesn't make a lot of sense.
This is one of the things about nature, however. Nature is really never static. Things are always going through changes. Yes, we certainly understand the tie of the iconic Joshua tree with Joshua Tree National Park. But in our review, we looked 80 years into the future, and there will still be Joshua trees in Joshua Tree National Park.
Even without the listing under the Endangered Species Act, are there things the government does today to help with the conservation of the trees?
Unfortunately, that can be a misperception that if a species isn't listed, that it gets ignored. We work in conjunction with partners for research and conservation work, habitat restoration. There are also certain protective measures that states and even local communities have put into place where people cannot just go out and dig up or bulldoze their Joshua trees on their land. Also, the bulk of the land that Joshua trees occur on is already under federal management, and the federal managers do a very good job of certainly trying to maintain and ensure that they're keeping healthy populations.
Now, is this a final decision, or could it be appealed or maybe reconsidered in the coming months or coming years?
So we welcome any new scientific information on Joshua trees, and people can submit that to the Fish and Wildlife Service at any time. Also, if there comes a point where people have information that suggests that it may need protection under the Act, they can petition the service to do so.
That's Jane Hendren, spokesperson for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Jane, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
All right, moving on now to housing. Here's a real estate listing we came across today. A bright two-bedroom bungalow in Glassell Park with 1920s charm and renovated classic touches. Located in Larchmont Village, just blocks from shops and restaurants. The price tag, $600,000. Probably way less than what you would have guessed, because the unit I described is part of something called a tenancy in common quadruplex. That's a shared home approach that handles financing, division of ownership, maintenance, and taxation in unique ways. TICs, as they're known, are not new to California, but they're gaining traction here in LA as a more affordable way to buy a house. Jenna Chandler is an editor at Curbed LA. She's been writing about this. Jenna, welcome to Take Two.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, touched on it just briefly for a minute, but can you give us a more detailed breakdown of tenancy in common properties?
Yeah, so the best way to think about these is that they're like condos, but instead of owning your individual unit like you would with a condo, you own a share of the property, and your right to occupy the unit that you live in is spelled out in an agreement very similar to an HOA agreement.
So in a weird way, do you almost own a piece of the next person's place next door?
I guess that would be one way to think about it. But really, no one owns, you know, any individual unit. You all have a share of the property, and your share, it could be different based on the property. Some it's divided equally among all of the tenants, and sometimes it's based on the size of the unit that you're occupying.
Now, what about the loan process? Do TICs complicate that? How does that work exactly, say, from the buyer side?
Yeah, so you get an individual loan, which used to not be the case. You used to have to go in and get a group loan. You'd go in with whoever you plan to live with on the property and get one group together. Now you can get an individual loan. There's only one bank in Los Angeles that's offering loans for TICs.
Just one?
Just one,
oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sterling Bank from San Francisco, where TICs have been more common, you know, over the past, probably the past two decades. It's a more common form of property ownership there. So this bank is now doing loans in Los Angeles. It offers loans to developers to turn buildings into TICs, and then it offers loans to buyers. And the requirements are stricter than your average home loan. So they require that you put 10% down, which might seem low, but it's very possible that if you're not buying a TIC and you're just doing a traditional home loan, you might only put 4% down, yeah, for example. So the requirement is 10% down. You have to have a good credit score of at least 700.
All right. Now, as mentioned, TICs are not new to California. They're actually pretty popular in San Francisco, as you said, but not so much in LA. So what is behind the movement down here?
Yeah. So the fact that Sterling is doing loans here is behind it. They'd wanted to start doing this in LA before the recession hit, but then the recession hit, and that obviously kind of threw them off a little bit. But now, obviously, LA's housing market is thriving, and so they're here offering loans to investors and developers to turn multifamily buildings, usually older, beautiful, charming apartment buildings, and convert them into TICs. It's easier to do that than it is to do condos, so there's an advantage there for investors and developers. And then there's a brokerage here in LA, The Rental Girl. They're based in Highland Park, and they've been driving this movement. The two women who are doing TICs at the Rental Girl say they were working with renters for a long time, and they, you know, were kind of frustrated by the fact that a lot of their renters couldn't afford to buy homes in the neighborhoods where they were renting. So they brought this model forward as a way for renters to, you know, to invest in real estate and get, you know, get some equity in real estate.
And Liz McDonald's one of those people at the Rental Girl.
Yeah, she's the founder of the brokerage. Yeah.
What is she saying about how is this maybe getting people in places to live?
Yeah, she says, you know, this is kind of like breaking open the real estate market, you know, like the listing that you gave an example of when you opened the show, that doesn't $600,000, even though it's a lot of money, seems low for that neighborhood and for what you get for that money. So, you know, they're saying this is really great for first-time home buyers.
We're talking to Jenna Chandler, an editor at Curbed LA, about tenancy in common properties, or TICs. Now, a lot of these units come from developers and investors who have flipped multifamily buildings or older rent-controlled buildings in bungalow courts. Wondering, what does that mean, then, in terms of tenant displacement?
Yeah, so there's a big ethical and moral question that I think buyers who are considering this should weigh, and the LA Tenants Union would agree. They're saying that there are tenants who are being displaced from these properties because they do tend to be older buildings. They do tend to be buildings that were rent-controlled apartments, and in order to convert the units to for sale, the owners have to evict the tenants, and they do get cash relocation payments under the California Ellis Act, but the tenants union says, you know, we shouldn't be prioritizing home owners over renters. People are losing their homes because of this.
The thing is, I mean, the real estate market and just finding a place to live that you like, that's near things that you like, it's such a competitive thing. Some people might feel bad, but in the end, it's like, it's every person for themselves, right?
I mean, that's the way the market is set up now. So I think as a buyer, you have to decide, you know, what your priorities are and what your beliefs are.
Now, how have brokers like the Rental Girl who are pushing out these TICs responded to tenants' concerns?
I think they're standing by their personal beliefs and their approach to real estate, which is real estate is a commodity. And, you know, in their words, there are going to be winners and losers, and they're trying to help renters get into home ownership, and this is one way to do it.
Okay, these are new to LA, but they seem to be catching on. What are the risks, though? The risk to buying a TIC at this point?
Sterling Bank told me that actually the risks are so great, and so, you know, it's hard for buyers to wrap their head around what they're doing. And by the time someone gets to the point where they're considering actually taking out a TIC loan, once they hear about how it actually works, they say about half of potential buyers will actually proceed with the loan. So they do not, Sterling does not offer a 30-year fixed rate, which is kind of the standard in the real estate game. Most buyers, that's what they want. But your interest rate might only be locked in for 5 years, and then in 5 years, it could readjust to whatever the market is. So that's one potential risk. Another is resale value. This is still pretty new to LA. And if you're thinking, you know, this is my first time home, not my forever home, I'm going to sell it in a few years, it's kind of uncertain right now whether future buyers are going to be interested in this model. There's the fact that you are owning property with a group of people, and you have to make decisions together as a group about the property. And so that could lead to disputes. And then another risk might just be that because this is new, we don't know how policymakers might react to the model in a few years and maybe make it harder to buy or resell them. It's kind of unknown.
That's Jenna Chandler, editor at Curbed LA, writing about tenancy in common properties. Jenna, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, what is the official state fruit of California? Strawberries? Wrong. Grapes? Wrong again. What about nectarine? No, even more wrong. Unless you said avocados, you would be wrong. But you would be forgiven if you thought that California's official state fruit is the orange. Find out why when Take Two continues. And aren't you glad you listened to Take Two? Yeah, I had to go there.
I'm gonna settle down and never more roam and make the San Fernando Valley my home.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. Emmy Martinez. There's an orange ranch in the San Fernando Valley that the LA City Council wants to preserve as a historic cultural monument. They argue it's one of the last relics from LA's days as an agricultural hub, particularly for citrus. Along with backyard orange trees and non-commercial groves, it is a reminder of how the fruit shaped the state. For more on this slice of California's history, we have David Boulay. He's the author of The Orange and the Dream of California. David, thanks for coming in.
Great to be here. Thanks, A.
All right. Now, as you heard, there's a push to give this local orange orchard a monument status based on its historic significance. How would you describe the role of the orange in LA's history?
First, the orange was one of the original entities that attracted the kind of ambitious nonconformists that have created much of California's industry, whether it's movies, aerospace, Silicon Valley. Two, the orange was the first industrial agricultural enterprise here, so it set the stage for California to become the breadbasket of the world, which it continues to be to this day. And three, the idealized portrait of California and the orange was a pivotal part of creating California's image as a place of potential, a personal opportunity, and a plenty.
So the orange is a big deal around these
parts.
The
orange is a... I like to say that you can't exaggerate the importance of the orange on California. And as I write in my book, California was the orange, and the orange was California.
Oranges were first planted in Southern California by the Spanish at the San Gabriel Mission back in the early 1800s. About 30 years later, an L.A. resident named William Wolfskill comes into the picture. How did he help make oranges a commercial enterprise?
He was a native of Kentucky, came out here, and he began trying a number of different kinds of things to see agriculturally to see what would be successful. So he was planting grapes, all kinds of things. And the population at the time in Southern California was very, very small.
Yeah.
So there was no incentive to grow. But he had the idea, he was the first to have the idea that if he could put his oranges on trains and ship them to where the population was, he could do all right. And he did. He sent them to San Francisco during the era of the gold rush and immediately thereafter. And he became the first or second most wealthy person in California from growing of oranges. Then his son, John, took over from there and was among the first to ship fresh fruit across the country to where the major population was, to the East Coast and the Midwest.
Yeah. Now, okay, so Eliza Tibbetts, she's the one we get to thank for our seedless oranges. How did she change the game for growers?
She's a remarkable story. For a while, she lived in New York City where she was a practicing spiritualist. Then she and her husband, Luther, moved to California. She wrote to a former friend of theirs who was with the Department of Agriculture asking what they should plant here. And he sent them two budded varieties of a seedless orange that originally came from Brazil. And they planted them in their front yard. It is rumored that she watered them with her dishwater. Fortunately, she had neighbors who were commercial nurserymen. They helped her take care of the trees. And in a very short order, the fruit on that tree became very well known. And Eliza and her husband made a very nice, comfortable living for years selling cuttings from those two trees. And today, every single Washington navel tree in the world is a direct identical descendant of those two trees.
With that dishwater right there.
With that dishwater. Yeah, right? It was something in the water.
Yeah, I guess so. From that point, okay, shipping technology advances. Local growers come together and form California's Fruit Growers Exchange. How did that help California oranges really take off and spread around the country?
In the latter part of the 19th century, many people came here who had been doctors, lawyers, industrialists, and they came out here and it was paradise for them. There was snow in the mountains and there was the beach and the weather was always 72 degrees. And they looked for something to get involved with, and they got involved with citriculture. And they never called themselves farmers. They were always citralists or
citralists.
Or anything but dirt farmers. This had nothing to do with that. And they thought of themselves as improving society by growing this beautiful, healthy product. What they had going for them is they knew nothing about agriculture. So they were open to using business practices, to cooperation, and to hiring experts to tell them what to do. And so all of that allowed them to create a cooperative and to be then very successful in negotiating with the railroads and advertising and so on.
So you're not just selling oranges, you're selling the lifestyle, the California lifestyle.
Absolutely, yeah. Positively, yes.
Yeah. Okay, we're talking to David Boulay, author of The Orange and the Dream of California. The orange industry in its heyday, a pretty big piece of the California economy. Just how big was it?
It was incredibly big. In 1875, in Riverside, from the growing of oranges, Riverside had the highest per capita income in America.
Whoa, really?
And in 1920, so less than 100 years ago, the growing of oranges was the second largest revenue generator in the state behind only oil.
That's pretty incredible.
It's staggering, yeah.
Now, we know a lot about the people driving these companies and the people, the bigger names in this. What about the people actually picking the fruits? How do they support the orange industry survival in California?
The tension between large-scale agriculture and the need for continuous, skilled, knowledgeable workforce is one of the big California stories, and it continues to this day. When the building of the Transcontinental Railroads ended, many of the Chinese who were here had agricultural experience. And in fact, they had citrus experience. And they were the first citrus labor force. Then with the Chinese Exclusionary Act and other anti-immigration feelings at the time, their participation was minimalized, but there was a large Japanese population, and they also had agricultural background. They became the next wave of citrus workers. Then after that, there were Filipinos and then Mexicans.
Wow. So over the years, it really evolved and changed. Wow. Now, okay. Now, there aren't acres of oranges around Los Angeles today. What happened to the orange industry here? Where'd it go?
During World War II, millions of young men cycled through Southern California on their way to war and then back again. Many of them were taken with California and the weather and the mountains and the oceans and all the things we enjoy to this day.
Who wouldn't, right?
Who wouldn't? Yeah. And many of them migrated back here. So the land became too valuable for agriculture. So the citrus industry, agriculture, collapsed very rapidly. I like to say they were growing houses in the fields instead of produce.
Did it evaporate or move somewhere else?
It moved to two places. It moved to Tulare County up by Exeter and Porterville.
Yeah, Central California.
Central California. Yeah. There's still a large agriculture community and industry there. And then some of it moved to Arizona.
Okay. Now, the orange industry may be very different today. What mark, though, David, did it leave on our area? Where would Southern California be without oranges?
I think that the industries that came after citriculture might have eventually arrived, but oranges jump-started that development, and especially the portrayal of California as this idealized, spectacularly healthy, verdant, productive world helped encourage tourism, immigration, migration, and the establishment of all of these other industries.
That's David Boulay, author of The Orange and the Dream of California. He's been talking with us about the rise and fall of the Southern California orange industry. David, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thanks.
All right, there are a few iconic television shows that I'm a little ashamed to admit that I have never, ever watched. The Sopranos is a big one, not a single episode. Breaking Bad, yeah, that's another one. Just never got around to it. Coming up, a sitcom that was on for 10 seasons, 236 episodes that I have never, ever seen, is having a pop-up, a couple of pop-ups in L.A. Find out which show and where it'll pop up when Take Two continues. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm E. Martinez. Seniors who are homebound often don't have a lot of people around to keep track of how they're doing. Meals on Wheels is one program that's helped address that problem. And as KPCC's Michelle Faust-Ragovan reports, it may be able to do that part of its job even better with some relatively simple technology.
Richard Gaza gets out of his truck, grabs a bundle from the back, and heads up the steps of a small mobile home in Anaheim. The 84-year-old retiree has been making this trip once a week for about 10 years.
This is lunch and breakfast.
He's delivering meals for SeniorServe, a Meals on Wheels program. Gaza stocks the fridge for two sisters who he visits each Monday.
Today they're having this drumstick roll, coleslaw, salad, dessert.
Dorothy is the elder sister at 101 years old. She says she looks forward to seeing Gaza.
Richard has been a blessing in a lot of ways. Even his taking time to talk with us sometimes when we're kind of low. Okay.
Dorothy lives with her 92-year-old sister, Helen. Our interview was arranged on condition that we not use their last names. Gaza helps them by opening jars and putting new batteries in their hearing aids. Helen also appreciates the time that Gaza and other drivers spend with her and her sister.
They've all been so good to us, talking to us about things going on in the world, which when you don't get out and do stuff, you become isolated. And they bring us out of that.
Gaza enjoys hanging out a little longer. The three have developed a friendship after so many years of weekly visits. It also gives him a little information about the two to help SeniorServe make sure the sisters are okay.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay. Bye.
Thank you, number
one. Okay.
Bye.
Once he leaves, Gaza pulls out an app on his smartphone and reports that the meals have been delivered. Then he marks down whether there's been any change in Helen and Dorothy's conditions.
Anything that's out of the ordinary, if they're walking wobbly, they're dizzy.
A social worker back at SeniorServe gets the report immediately and will follow up. Helen says she and Dorothy are lucky because they have each other and family nearby.
Well, I do have a daughter and a son-in-law, and they help us a lot.
Oh, yeah. In fact, her granddaughter was over this morning.
Tracy Hall, director of volunteer services at SeniorServe, says for many of the homebound older adults who get meals delivered to them, the driver who brings the meal is the only person they interact with regularly.
Nobody sees our seniors. Our homebound seniors are hidden behind closed doors.
And that can be dangerous to their health. Hall calls her drivers the eyes and ears, who might be the first to spot depression, a worsening health condition, or a need for more assistance.
A lot of times it could be something as simple as they're not able to get up and move about as much as they were before, and so maybe they just need a walker.
Research has proven Meals on Wheels programs can not only reduce feelings of loneliness, but falls in hospitalization rates as well. Initial research on the app suggests it could do even more to help clients. SeniorServe is one of 26 Meals on Wheels sites around the country that have tested the app. It's working on a plan to expand the program to all 16 cities where it delivers in Orange County. Back at Helen and Dorothy's house, Helen says her 101-year-old big sister still gives her a hard time.
In all my life, she's bossed me from the time I was young, you know, voice of authority.
It never changes.
It never does. I mean, really.
And Meals on Wheels hopes its new app will help keep the sisters healthy as long as possible. Covering health, I'm Michelle Faust-Ragavan.
All right, there is a lot to do this weekend if you don't have plans, and we got your guide right here.
I'm KPCC's Leo Duran, and A. Martinez, I hope you trained at the gym all week.
Oh, you know I did.
Yeah, because this weekend, none of these events are for slouchers.
I got my headband on, so tell me.
Well, take off that headband, because get your helmet ready for Ciclavia on Sunday. This time, it's called Meet the Hollywoods. That's because the path stretches from West Hollywood to plain-flavored Hollywood to East Hollywood. North Hollywood. You're actually not included
in this
mix. I
know, it exists.
Sorry. That means cars are cut off from traveling Main Street, so people can bike, scooter, whatever their way across the city. Also, I am seriously trying to figure out how I can convince my friends to make a daytime trip to the bar at Jumbo's Clown Room, which is actually along the route.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, but more family-friendly, think of stops like the Playground Plumber Park and getting breakfast at Trejo's Donuts.
Yeah.
Starts at 9 a.m. and runs into the afternoon, and of course, it's free.
All right, what about for my Instagram feed?
Then, if you're the kind of person who likes to do experience things and take pictures of it, head to the Citadel Outlets on Saturday. The mall hosts Neon Summerfest. There will be neon and fluorescent everything around you at this block party like food, fashion, life-size board games, the dance floor. Plus, several stores will have one-day discounts to add to the party. And this one's free, too.
All right, two more events. Music lovers, though.
Okay, yeah, this first one is for the Beach Bums. Tomorrow is the Hermosa Beach Summer Series. It's a festival along the shore, so you can hang up by the water, listen to some music, hear some comedy, watch some screenings. Plus, there's a big health component, so you can do things like morning yoga and beach tennis. That one's free. And then there's one more in Chinatown. It's Sunday night at LA Historic Park. It's called Yola Dia Fest, and it's a music festival that features some of the best female musical acts out there, like... That's Leaky Lee. She also performing is Cupcake, who I'd also like to play right now too, but well, the lyrics aren't exactly radio friendly. And Cat Power. Kind of cool about this event is that the rest of the event staff is female fronted, from the bartenders to security. And when you go, passes start at $85. Now, there's actually a lot more going on this weekend. Check out the full list of events on las.com. That's laist.com. And you can find me online on Twitter at LeoHasACats.
That's KPCC's very radio friendly Leo Duran giving us a preview of all the great stuff to do this weekend. Leo, thanks a lot.
Au revoir.
Rachel, Monica, Joey. If you're of a certain age, these names will probably bring one thing to mind. That's right, Friends, the hugely popular sitcom from the 90s. Now, this year, the show celebrates its 25th anniversary, and the local Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf chain is paying some tribute. Starting today, at locations on the 3rd Street Promenade in Santa Monica and on Beverly Boulevard in West Hollywood, the coffee shops will temporarily transform into Central Perk Cafe. Now, for the uninitiated, that's the coffee shop where a lot of the Friends action took place way back in the day, and it sounds like an Instagrammer's paradise. So if you've ever wanted to lounge on the famous orange couch, now is your chance. And if you've dreamed of sipping a Rachel matcha latte or a Chandler caramel coconut latte or some other Friends themed coffee drink while sitting on that couch, well, you're going to find those on the menu as well. The Central Perk Cafe pop-ups at the Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf will be open through next Friday. So cheers! Now, that's a different show. All right, another great show is The Frame. That's KPCC's arts and entertainment show. It's on weekdays at 3:30, Saturdays at 2. And today is Chloe Veltman. She is guest hosting for John Horn. Hi, Chloe.
Hi.
All right, so today on the show, a bit of a serious topic. You know, earlier this week, we had some of our Latino listeners kind of weigh in on how they're feeling after the El Paso shootings, because that was targeted at Mexicans. And now Hollywood has responded in a big way.
That's right. So we spoke with Gloria Calderon-Kellett, who's the showrunner and co-creator of the series One Day at a Time. And along with these other prominent Latino members of the entertainment industry, she signed an open letter today to the Latinx community responding to current immigration policies and the recent shooting in El Paso.
Yeah, Eva Longoria signed on that letter.
So America Ferrera.
Yeah, so a lot of big names on
that.
Yeah,
and around 200 people in total, leaders in total, sorry, 200 leaders.
That's awesome. Yeah. Now, okay, what's on the show this Saturday at 2?
Well, we have lots of things, including Taylor McFerrin, son of the vocalist Bobby McFerrin.
Oh, yeah.
He's talking about his
new album.
Don't
Worry, Be Happy. That's his dad's song.
That's his dad's song. He doesn't really sing, and this is the first album where he's actually singing himself, which is a great thing. And Hornaday, movie critic with the Washington Post, joined me also to talk about the way in which movies are being increasingly prejudged before the people doing the judging actually see them. She wrote about this trend in the wake of the cancellation of the satirical film The Hunt earlier this week.
Yeah.
And now it looks like, as a result of all the prejudging, no one's actually going to get to see it. And then we also have a story about something that's going on in San Francisco, which is where I live. It's to do with a contentious mural at a public high school, which shows depictions of this dark side of colonialism. And this mural has stirred a national debate. It's made international headlines.
I've heard about that. That is a great story. Yeah. All right. So that's coming up on The Frame on Saturday at 2. And then The Frame today, 3:30. Chloe Veltman filling in for John Horn. Chloe, thanks a lot.
Yeah, you're welcome.
That's it for Take Two this week. The show was edited by Sue Carpenter. Our directors are Lori Skywalker-Galaretta and Leo Duran. Tamika Adams is our news apprentice. The program engineer by Hazmik Pogosian. Senior producer this week, Austin Cross. Our recently departed intern, who we forgot to give a shout out last week, is Brandon Young. So there you go, Brandon. I'm A. Martinez. You can find me on Twitter at A. Martinez LA. Take Two is back Monday at 2. Talk to you then.